Good evening and welcome to Radio Alchemy, where we fuse the fringe with conventional wisdom. From secret societies to out-of-body experiences, black budget technology to this new world disorder, we want you to join us each week as we look at this thing called life with all the pieces. And thank you, darlings, for coming back late night on yet another first of this 2004. So great to be with you. Thank you for being the late night listeners that you are. All right, loves. So something fun, something groovy tonight in our first hour. You know how usually we, come in with a particular topic, something that we're going to talk about. Well, tonight, it's going to be free form, like conversation, like you're a fly on the wall listening to just some jibber jabber, tangential machinations amongst us little kitties of the night. And the kitty that I get to play with tonight is Bob Dobbs. And so that's going to be fun, picking the brain of Bob, finding out more about Bob, and expanding into the realm of the flesh and in and out of the android meme, and just learning a little bit more and just being able to ask whatever question I want. Isn't that great? We're just going to sit down and have a chat. In the second hour, Virgil Armstrong, you know that gentleman, he travels around the world talking about his interaction with alien races, what message he has got about the cosmology, about what this whole game is about, the balancing of the male and female principle, which is the most important thing coming into the third quarter? Is this the third quarter and fourth quarter's coming up after 2012? I don't know. But what it is, it's activation right now for all of you folks. High, high activation. And so in the second hour, Virgil Armstrong, and please say a prayer for him. He has suffered a stroke and a secondary stroke over the last 8 months. It has sidelined him, and he has not been able to get back in the game and travel and talk to people and give them hope. So in your prayers, please put Virgil Armstrong in there, and also Hartford Van Dyke, who for his efforts to hold judges accountable has been given an 8-year sentence in Washington State. So a lot of people that are doing the work for all of us out there who are just being, silenced and put aside. As you know, Virgil has had other attempts upon his life, now they're just trying to incapacitate him, but he won't be finished because he is here tonight with us in the second hour. All right, loves. So stay tuned. Coming back with Bob in this first hour, second hour, Virgil Armstrong. Say a prayer for them and for all of us because we need that kind of energy. KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. This is Radio Alchemy, and we'll be back with Bob. All right, loves. Yeah, so much fun. Now, this CD that I'm playing, it's really great. I got it at DEF CON, at a hackers convention out in Las Vegas that I make sure and venture to in like the August-September mode. It would be great if you guys would venture out there to lovely Las Vegas at some time to see what is going on new in the hacking community. And some guy named Ron Miller. Really fun. But now, hi, Bob.
Hey, Eben. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, man. How are you?
Fine, as usual. I've never been anything else.
hold it, man. I could imagine through the trials and tribulations of your life in playing beyond 007. You must be 0014 or something, man, 0022.
Well, I'm a pentad, so I'm 7, 22, 18, 14, and 8.
All at once?
Yeah.
Numerologically, what does that boil down to?
Immortality.
Okay. Well, how do we get on that train?
Just take the 8 and put it on the side. It's an infinity sign.
Yes.
Just like Bush, his second term is going to be 44th president. 4 and 4 is 8. So that's when he's going to get immortality. Take us all the way to Mars.
Oh, for crying. Yeah. Yeah, great.
Oh, you don't like the image of Bush. You have a problem with the image of Bush.
No. I think having a beaver for a president is a fabulous image to send out all the way all over the globe as a representative of the kind of person I stand behind.
Let me tell you why Bush is the greatest artist alive today. The image of Bush, mm-hmm. The personal Bush, is got nothing to do with anything. It's the image that's, and the milieu and the atmosphere it creates. The reason Bush's image is so appropriate is that it's an anti-environment, a counter-environment to the information society. Here's a guy who represents no information intake, and that's what we need. He's satirizing every one of us who live by information more and more now, unfortunately.
Well, saying that information is irrelevant because I have my finger on the button? I mean, how does he satirize?
No, he doesn't communicate. He says silly, incomplete sentences. He appears stupid. Paul O'Neill said that he was a blind man in a room of deaf people. He doesn't have anything to talk about or dialogue. He's dead information-wise, dialogic-wise. That's the image we need today to remind us of how silly our information society is. So hats off to the greatest image for satirical review of our time presented by those who created the image of George Bush.
Well, I mean, if their information is dead, that means that somehow we have stopped progressing because we make news. The actions of individuals make information, reporting what other individual Homo sapiens have been doing in this way and churning
dead,
on.
When you say dead, that means finitude, that we've come to a point. The information society is not dead. It just doesn't have a point, an ending. It's a never-ending, non-finish line situation.
Well, what would
and
expect,
most people aren't able to handle that.
What would expect for anything to have an ending? Why would there be an ending to news? Why would
you
there be an ending to information?
You were brought up in literacy. You were brought up with the period. Period not cannot be used now, but they don't teach that in school.
Period. Can we're brought up with the period? Yes, yes, yes. But that's only to, in a sense, stop a run-on sentence. Well, to stop a thought.
No, but people go around looking for meaning now. They maintain that literate idea of having a purpose, a goal. And most of our societies is a service environment providing temporary goals for people, all because people can't live in the infinite, eternal, no finish line situation.
Well, then we're getting back to that fundamental problem where there needs to be a redefinition of what it is to be human, because if our purpose then has become obsolete, does that mean if information is obsolete does that necessarily mean that our purpose is? I mean, it can't be. It is under this schemata of environments that we live under, which, you know, just wants us to work and consume, but with a new definition. We could, you know, elevate or do something different with the period, turn it into three dots, dot, et cetera.
I'm all for redefining what that image is of the information environment. That's what I do. I redefine it. I've already done it. You just go to my chart. I lay it out. I've answered it. Now, how am I going to connect with anybody else about that?
Well, you are. There are people out there that I know are going to the McLuhaninstitute.org that are listening to your interviews and that are thinking about this gooey mess, this extension of media, and starting to understand. Because you know what I'm doing? Like in the second hour at the end, I'm reading different chapters I'm reading the book by Edward Bernays, Propaganda. And in that, he is talking about being able to structure diversity through putting out of ideas across media. So that is the very toddler area of media and its importance. And that definitely plays back in, and people can then understand from that controls what you're talking about, which is, you know, stratospheric.
Right. It was Jacques Ellul, a French philosopher, who said back in the 60s that propaganda was not its messages, the content sent out. It was the whole culture in action. And that's a good way to understand and begin to see that form is the one that shapes people propagandistically. But the interesting thing now is that form has merged with content, and actually content dominates form. That's where we've come to a very interesting situation now. And that's another aspect of redefining what propaganda is, because we're the ones who create the propaganda now, just so that we can keep the content going.
Yes. Okay, well, let's get to you, Dag Nabbit. And
okay.
we're gonna merge around. Who are you, Bob?
I am the matrix, in the sense that I'm the one who understands the big picture, even though the phrase picture is not frameable today. I'm the one, every period, every era, depending on what culture you're from, has someone who is able to frame their time, our time. That's what I do. I'm the one who's mastered. I'm the Einstein. I'm the McLuhan. I'm the Gurdjieff. I'm the Lenny Bruce. I'm whatever you think is important and valuable. I've mastered it.
And how would you describe your occupation? What do you do to be able to attain that stance?
There's many levels. Spiritually, we could say I set it up before I reincarnated. And I was given permission by those that I set up the life with. That's one way to look at it, right?
Right.
I was able to gull a few, guff and gull some souls that would agree to sponsor me that way once I arrived here and they arrived here. That's one way. Another reason is that if you grew up in my environment, which was access to the most powerful people in the old 1984 sense, their Orwellian sense, in the first half of the 20th century, then you'd have an advantage over a lot of people. If you lived among the what they call the Illuminati, even though that's a hokey term, there was such a management team in the pre-1970 period. And so I grew up in that and just was born into it. Might have been the luck of the draw. And then I was lucky, in a sense, if you disregard the spiritual reason and the environmental where I was born reason, just that the accident, the chaos butterfly, led me to these places for unknown reasons. The people that I interacted with were probably the greatest people that one could interact with to get in the position where I am. As a young man, look at who I knew. I knew James Joyce. I knew T.S. Eliot. I knew Wyndham Lewis. I knew Gurdjieff. I knew Duchamp. And then later, I knew Marshall McLuhan, Frank Zappa, Lynda LaRouche, Mae Brussel, and many people that aren't that well-known. Well-known people, you can name anybody. I knew them and interacted with them. I was there when Hoffman invented LSD. Now, how could you explain all these things happening to me?
And how old were you when you were with Hoffman?
I was 21, because I was born in 22, and he got that wonderful day in April 43, I think it was, so I would have been 22 and 44, so I was 21. I was actually around that week. Now, I didn't know that was going to happen to him. I was assigned to visit him because he was working for a secret team out of Basel in Switzerland, which had links back to the Theosophical Society, and they were trying to make what's called the peace bomb. And there was a whole history of an elite that was trying to develop a drug that LSD turned out to be. And I was sent there. You know, an interesting thing, another person I met was Dave Worser, the channel for Cosmic Awareness, and also I was lucky to meet the Evergreens, which was channeled by Michael Blake Reed, which we've talked about. But I remember it came through Cosmic Awareness that Hoffman, when he was sort of making the LSD in 38 accidentally and sat on a shelf for 5 years, the making of that was paralleled by a... not a well-known aristocrat, but among aristocratic circles, well-known, this man climbed a very high mountain. The action of climbing the high mountain was a metaphor for and interacted with the mind of Hoffman making LSD. So, you know, a person walking down the street in Beijing right now may be having a big influence on the quality of this interview, because I believe and have been given proof of that all 6 billion of us are interconnected. So maybe it was significant that I was there with Hoffman for that week, that would happen. You know, just my physical presence, that nothing to do with my ego or personality, just my being. Just like the being of that person climbing the mountain was important for Hoffman to make the breakthrough. Just like, you see what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
That the actions of everybody has this amazing hidden implication that is God's view.
Yes.
Or spirit's view of the whole wonderful geometry of everybody interacting, a constant ecology going on. You have to remember that if one could even conceive it.
Yes. So Bob, how was it that you got yourself into these circles? Did you use a particular moniker, a cover? How did you introduce yourself, and how was it that you were able to speak of these, you know, these great minds at such a high level? Why did they divulge to you?
Because it was my father, who was a butler for very wealthy people, and we'd been a butler family for 300 years, and Charles Dickens even talks about us in an essay as a journalist he wrote around 1853-54 called The Toady Tree. You can look it up in the collection of his miscellaneous writings. And he talks about the Dobbs family in there. That would be my great-grandfather. The thing is that after World War One, the aristocrats were in the quote, Illuminati of Europe, were in a weakened position because automobiles, airplanes, telephones, cars were just moving into a what I call a software communist environment for the whole planet. And the old 19th century, 18th century way of managing money systems wasn't going to work anymore. So the elites that my father worked for understood that artists were and scientists were picking up on what was really going on. So they started studying people like T.S. Eliot and James Joyce, especially Finnegan's Wake, as it was published in Transition magazine in the 20s and early 30s. They were tracking that. There used to be copies of that magazine in my home, and let's see, I would have been 10, 12, 15, 16. And my father used to go to meetings of the Priory of Sion. The famous Priory of Sion was what my father was a member of in Paris. And it was, now Joyce and Lewis and these people were always interested in power and the secret elements of power. All great artists are. It's part of the art of life is to understand how life is hypnotized or molded, because that's what an artist does. He replays the process of hypnosis in the medium of his choice, his or her choice. So these people were befriended by my father. So I met them, a lot of them, through my father. That was the interesting thing. I mean, he was a man who was an eccentric and interested in things. I mean, the Merovingian in Matrix 3 is a model of my father. I mean, one of my father's like, that guy is my father. And he was an eccentric, and he had his own personal interests. But he also was part of a team of people that had to know what was going on. I was sent around to look at interesting new developments in technology and information. That's what my job was. Sort of like a spy, but it wasn't really that serious at that point. I mean, Hoffman was a friend of associates, my father.
And so, but once you went out on your own, and like, tell us about how you came to be good friends with Marshall McLuhan.
Well, I was involved in the reestablishment of the Shah of Iran in 53 in Iran, right?
Right.
And we knocked off the nationalist government there. And then I was involved in the machinations in Guatemala. And I was working for a faction in Europe that lost to the CIA, to put it in simple terms. And I had screwed up, and so the team in Europe kind of didn't like having me working in Europe, so they banished me to North America, which they considered not a very important position. That was really typical of the Europeans' blindness in the early 50s. They thought Paris was the world headquarters and everything, but they didn't understand what TV was going to do. So I end up in New York in late 53. I look at my friend Duchamp, who's in New York. And, you know, I'm just a young man. I'm just 31 at that point. And I ended up going to Toronto because I was instructed in New York that there was a professor in Toronto who was writing in a new journal and exposing the sort of the knowledge of James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake and how we in the Solar government were going to use that. And it was a professor who had cracked the code, so I was there to go up there and find out how this happened. So that's when I went and saw Marshall McLuhan and then eventually ingratiated myself into his world in 54, 55. And I quickly found out that he got that information from Wyndham Lewis, who I had met back when I was 15 or so in Paris through my father. And that was the first time Xenocrony occurred to me. I'm sent out to find out this mysterious man. How did he figure this out? How did he crack the Illuminati in quotes codes? And it turns out he found out through coincidence people that I knew. And that was the beginning of my life of bumping into people that were reflections of my life that had already been laid out. So I kept, as life went on, it just got tighter and tighter where, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that we're related in some way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we may not be, But right. that's an example. I've never been able to get out of the tunnel of connections and coincidences that have, that in retrospect, have controlled my life.
Let's take a break right here. We are on the line with Bob Dobbs. It is Free Form tonight, and it is so much fun. Really great for 2004. We'll have to do this with all of our great minds that we bring on once in a while. All right, loves. KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. We'll be back right after this break. Radio Alchemy.
Eclipsing conventional wisdom. All alchemists converge at www.radioalchemy.com for streaming audio and more.
And so, right before this break, Bob, we were talking about the synchronicity.
Let me tell you, it just happened again. If I was asked to sum up in a soundbite what Joyce was doing with Finnegan's Wake,
yeah,
I'd say convergence through radio alchemy. And I just heard those words on your promo. I've never heard your promo before. And now there's an example of synchrony. You are using a phrase from someone you're interviewing, and you're trying to figure out what I mean, and I'm trying to tell you something that you already are using in your promos. So how do you like that for synchronicity?
That's cool. That's very cool, man.
Remember that. So I'm going to ask you, what's Finney's Wake about? It's about convergence through radio alchemy. And that is literally true,
well,
what he did.
Wow. Well, okay. I am completely honored even to be in the same sentence as James Joyce. That's so cool. So let me ask you this then. But first, hold it. Going back into ingratiating yourself, you come up, you knock on the door. Did you see him? Give us the whole play-by-play of how an intelligence professional such as yourself ingratiates himself into probably these snooty chapters and ivory towers in America.
Yeah.
Or Canada.
You always flatter the person you're going to. I go there and say, I read your first issue of Explorations, came out in December 53, and I found it very interesting. I didn't fully understand it, but I was wondering if we had 15 minutes to, you can answer some questions, just like you're doing to me.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, you come in tomorrow morning, come in at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning when I finish my class, and we go talk. And then once I'm there and we're talking, that's when my living in the present and where my intuition and genius comes in, because I've got to get him interested in my curiosity and responses to his answers to me.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And that's what you do. And then he'll say, well, I wish we had more time to talk. I got to go to another class. And I said, well, I'll be back in 2 weeks.
Right.
You never rush it. I'll be back. Actually, I'm going to be staying there for 2 weeks. But I'll be back in 2 weeks. Can I drop in again? Sure, no problem. And that's what you do. So you have to go in there knowing nothing and being ready to respond and actually learn something from the person.
Right.
That's what you do. If you faking sincerity is to actually be open to learning something. And
right.
even though you don't give a f*** that you're learning it,
right.
you are actually having the pleasure of the eureka of the moment.
My gosh, I have to... That you said the naughty word. But, okay, that's amazing. So now, at what point did you know that you've heard enough? At what point did your assignment become fulfilled? When did you know that?
When I found out, it took a while to find out it was from Wyndham Lewis. And when that happened, when we found that out, then we understood it. And because Lewis went back to, remember, he wrote a novel about a historian who wrote the secret history of World War II during World War II. This was a character in a novel which was inside a novel called Self-Condemned, which was about Wyndham Lewis's life during World War II in exile in Toronto when he met McLuhan, and he actually has McLuhan as a character in his novel. Now, how do you like that?
Wow.
You should read Self-Condemned. It's a novel by Wyndham Lewis about his exile during World War II in Toronto, and the character that's really modeled on Lewis is a professor of history who writes a book called The Secret History of World War II during World War II.
Okay, so...
So then he knew a lot.
Yes, he did know a lot.
And he was a good friend of Joyce and Lewis and these people, and Eliot and Pound. And they knew so much, they looked like elitist and aristocrats, and now postmodern literary critics call them fascists.
They were just seeing it the way they called it, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
in retrospect.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you are a part, would you say that you are part of something that controls, directs, or monitors and manipulates? Are you part of a stratosphere that does any of those functions?
We had to know what and how to control people before World War One. After World War One, it took 10 years in the crash of the economy, late 20s, early 30s, when the owners lost control of money. The crash of the economy was when money could not be a source of control. That's why money was made public property through the New Deal in the United States, mm-hmm. through socialism in European countries. Mm-hmm. The creating the economy where, and this was Keynesian economics, where you could now go in debt, and the people were guaranteed a basic pittance, a wage, no matter if they're working or not, the welfare state.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, ownership did not control power as it traditionally was orchestrated through money systems, money and credit. So there was a new form of power. And basically, it was keeping people bombarded by information, mm-hmm. Like through radio and television. Knowing that meant that the only way to maintain control is to know what new technologies that would create information environments would be coming in. Mm-hmm. And to keep on top of them, and in some ways own them. But that wasn't really that important. Owning now is only a small part of the Android meme. It's that part of historical legacy of visual space and print culture that came out of the 18th, 19th century, which is part of our technological legacy, and it's still there. It's a meme, but it is not the dominant meme. It's like one-fifth of a five-fifths operation. Like my chart shows the five-fifths.
Right.
And the 19th century and money that LaRouche is always analyzing,
yes.
is only 20%, one-fifth. And that's not where we live anymore, and the majority. So there really was no basis of power in any sense. The people had taken over. The super audience, like the super enterprise, works for itself. And that's been a fact since World War II.
So to whose end, like who are you working for? If I know there are a lot of names that we probably never heard of before. And to what end? What would it matter to them since they have this money and they have their life? And look, we're just, we're a bunch of, people that just want to live and be able to enjoy life, et cetera. You know, what do they need for anything to keep up on these new technologies and do all this if what we just want to do is to, eat, consume, and work? What is their big interest in this?
Well, there was an interest in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. But by 60s, when Rait returned to essence, the original separateness goes back thousands of years that was set up by us as spirit, there was no reason to exercise that elitism anymore. And it's only those that don't know what to do with themselves that stay in New York City and live in their little co-op prisons and eat polluting food. If you actually want to have a healthy life and live highly geared toward achieving probably 150-year lifestyle that like people like Gary Null say can happen,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to live in New York City, at least permanently. That destroys your body in New York City.
Mm.
And so what traditionally was a position of luxury and well-being is not true anymore. The world turned upside down.
Mm.
Now, to find places of health is hard because there's so many different kinds of pollution on the planet. But the point is, to have to be Bill Gates is a tremendous disservice to yourself because you're stuck with a role and you have to deal with that image in public all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's so unimaginative about what he wants to do that he collects all these old paintings.
Right, and digitizes them.
yeah, And I can hear better music and see better paintings just by watching television or movies or videos. I can stimulate my eye through imagery, plus hearing great music right there in popular media with all the variety of channels there are. If I want to have experience ecstasy. And this is available to anybody in North America.
Right.
So we don't have the old traditions of wealth. That's why, you know, Prince Charles takes it. Look at Prince Charles. What a loser. I mean, to have to go around and play that particular one act, one role.
Right.
It drove him crazy. It drove Lady Diana crazy. And I knew these people. I was the one who introduced Diana to Prince Charles.
What?
Yeah. I was the one who was organized. It was the necessary mating, and I'm the one who had to act it out. But but that's just a side thing. These people are. There's not a person who makes it big in media terms and celebrityhood that doesn't suffer greatly. From Jack Nicholson to who's the latest, Britney Spears. The point is that they are in an economy of abuse value. If you get on the media, you're abused in more ways than you can imagine.
Yes.
So the citizen has to be real smart. Take advantage of the abuse value and the stimulation and the cultural products they make, but don't get caught in the crossfire.
Is that why the celebrities, you know, Susan Sarandon, Jan Garofalo, and all these types that came out against the war, that they ducked? I mean, they're still doing stuff like this Bush in 30 seconds kind of deal, but they're not on the airwaves. They're not really out front going against the war because they got really nailed, didn't they?
Yeah, well, they don't know how to do it intelligently. Now, Susan Sarandon is an interesting person, not for her politics, but in a recent interview, I don't know, People Magazine, one of those places, they were complimenting at how well she looked at the age of 56 or something, and she touted Gary Noll's product, one of his products, Green Stuff or something. Now, that's a smart woman because she knows that to eat regular stuff that wealthy people are supposed to eat in exclusive restaurants, which will hurt your health if you tend to do it too much, and just a few times is too much almost, she understands to go to a very unconventional way of eating to have a better sense of body feeling. And,
yes.
You know, you can do that with some of Gary's products or other people that think like Gary. And Connie, my partner. So the thing is that she's an example of someone who is going and using her wealth intelligently. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, let me ask you this.
But that's only for her flesh body. Now, in her politics, you know, she and Tim are naive about what the whole situation is. And that's why they, I don't know if they care that they get beat up in the media, but maybe their fans think it's a problem.
Okay,
they may not care that they weren't invited to the Hall of Fame thing or whatever it was, baseball. But my job is to get us to our resistance to be done through incredible, interesting articulation like I do, that confuses the reporters and media and our enemies, Tom Ridge, whoever thinks they're trying to surveil us. We've got to come up with a more interesting way of critiquing the society.
Certainly, certainly. But let me ask, to what end is the monitoring and controlling and all of that kind of, you know, nonsense?
That's for private identity. There, you know, 6 billion people. You got people that aren't in Europe and North America, in other parts of the world, who want to, one-fifth of themselves, want to go through the hologram of industrial software communism, hardware communism of the 19th century. They want to have a private identity. They want to have a private home. They never had it that way, the way we've had it in the West. And they want to experience that. And that attracts them. And so the money system is a meme and a hologram to keep that sense of sociological order going. Our job is to help them move into other memic post-money environments, which are memes now, and get to the point of understanding what I'm talking about as they grow up, because there are all these immigrants coming to New York. They're going to come here. They're going to have a nice job, be a nurse in a hospital. They won't be aware that medicine is the biggest killer in the United States.
Right.
They won't be aware that they're going to get polluted on their lunch hour in some form in New York City. You
That's
know what
right.
I mean?
That's
they're
right.
just going to be glad that they have security of a middle-class existence and a bit of peace, which they didn't have in South America,
yes.
you know, for decades, due to the Western culture.
Yes.
you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Here's a tangent in talking about that. Big thing about Bush's immigration policy. I was just listening to some folks talking about California as being a part of Mexico, and that's true from the wars and everything from the past. But is there a much higher level war going on? And the reason why we have immigrants coming here is because of the neglect of their governments, the corruption of their governments. That's why people are coming here. And we have a corruption of a different type, but theirs is so blatant and so disgusting.
But they're not coming here. They're not going to a purer place. They're going to a different kind of environment, a theme park.
Yes,
where they have a house
park.
And they read the newspaper and they go to their job and they have a union and they have weekends and they don't have gorillas sniping at them.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Exactly. But what I'm wondering is
these holograms are the cultures made are floating around inside the global theater.
Yes.
Now.
But let me ask, is there something to, even though these cultures and these memes are projected out and everybody sees the United States hologram as the best one to get a hold of, what does it mean, though, the real-life manipulation of these governments to not allow self-determination? Why isn't it that they are not creating the Shangri-La right there in their own homeland?
In the other countries they come from,
right? Why aren't they just creating the U.S. meme for themselves, where they have their land, their people, etc.?
Because that is physical nature, which is just 1/5 of our situation. We all live in this resonating node. If you saw 60 Minutes last weekend, all the people that are calling you for various purposes, various sales, marketing, all that spam you get is coming from places like India. And India is right here in our homes in North America, and we're right inside their homes. There is no geographical distinction between anywhere on the planet. And so what people are looking for is access to environments. So they come to North America because you can get a car faster, and you get radio, and you can get TV and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You see? And they think that, I mean, it's just like you live in a town. No, you actually live in a hotel. And you want to get to the penthouse suite because they got swimming pools up there, they got TV, they got everything you'd want on a hedonistic level. But you got to work your way up through the floors, and there's all kinds of different violences going on in the floors on the way up.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still in the same building. You're just trying to shift to a better floor.
Right.
That's
right.
Where we are.
Yes.
And the building is not even an appropriate metaphor. We are nowheres.
Yeah.
We are in the same resonating point.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to go back into stuff we've talked about in other sessions. But there's nowheres to walk to in terms of national identity. There's no United States. There's no Colombia. There's no China in the most advanced environments that we live in. They're only there when you have to start using paper. And you look at a newspaper, and it comes from a place called New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But the information, the content of the newspaper comes from this resonating node, this digital place that's manufacturing information out of the White House. And then it gets fragmented into different disciplines.
Yes.
So, you know, let's remember, there's nowhere to go, you know, for your chip body and your TV body.
Hmm.
All right?
Okay.
But your physical body needs to go around and get a bit of food. But even that food becomes a pizza.
Let me ask you this. We have around 2 minutes until our next break. What is the, and we're kind of flipping gears here.
I would just add that the immigrants coming to New York don't know they're not leaving where they came from.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
They're only, geographically, they're only getting access to environments that put them right back where they were and which are bigger than where they were.
Better toys.
Yeah, no, they want to experience the cloned ESP that we live in.
Okay.
They want to be at headquarters, a sense of the center of it, which is not true.
Okay, start up answering this. We have a minute left. What is the importance of bloodlines? You mentioned the Prior de Sion, you mentioned the Merovingians, bloodlines in around 40 seconds, and we'll pick it up when we come back after the break. But what's that importance?
There's no importance in bloodline. That is only for the medium of money and who is one person as opposed to another. They have a name, their birth certificate says it is, it's written out in print. That visual identification goes back to the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, and that's when it was important to have bloodlines and to know who it is, and that is not important now, but there is still that historical legacy as a meme, as a hologram, that rotates around, and now it's part of zine culture. You know, people claim they're in touch with the prior sign. It's a myth. It's a fable.
Well, it is now a fable, but back then it was significant. Obviously, your father was involved.
Yeah, the people my father worked for, it was important. But see, by after 1917, 18, it wasn't important. It took another 20 years to really hit home, and then World War II proved it. You talk to a wealthy person in the United States in the 30s, the big revolution after World War II for an average wealthy person in Philadelphia was you couldn't get servants anymore.
Very good. Okay, we're going to pick it up from there. Hey, we are chatting it up with Bob Dobbs. This is Radio Alchemy. I'm your host, Evan Ray. Thank you guys for being late night listeners. And we're going to be back right after this short break. This is KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County. Radio Alchemy.
Eclipsing conventional wisdom. All alchemists converge at www.radioalchemy.com for streaming audio and more.
Well, Happy New Year again to all of you lovelies, Radio Alchemy. We are on the line with Bob. Yes, Bob. And so, it's really great fun. What we are doing is just chatting it up, and we're so glad that you're hanging out with us and just doing really good, clean, fun, tangential conversation. And so the last question is bloodlines. They are obsolete. That's very interesting. So there's a book called The Holographic Universe. Explain holograms and how we could be one.
Well, once we had the TV environment in the 50s, and then that was subsumed by the computer environment, and then the satellite went around it in the early 60s. They had three rapid environments after World War II, TV, computer, that's mainframe computers, and then the satellite. Now, as the satellite becomes the dominant environment, it turns the previous environment into theatrical actors. So radio, magazines, bulldozers, buildings, telephones, chemical factories, IG Farben, all become actors inside the theater. But as the instant replay comes in, as I pointed out to you before we started the interview, there's a new book called 1968 by Mark Kurlansky, and he says the most important thing in 1968, which was an incredible year for events all around the world, of cultures communicating in all kinds of modes of resistance to each other, the hidden ground of that, he says, was the satellite and the instant replay or the video technology, the video cam or the videotape.
Right.
When you start bringing in videotape and satellite instant transmission, which creates the effect of the instant replay where you have the meaning before the experience. I mean, people saw replays of events before they had the event, before they were there to experience it. So the coverage at that point just turned the world into a point as metaphorized by the hologram, where you're in one point, you can see everything, and you are just one little point of the big picture, and the big picture is what is everything, but you can see everything from the little point inside it, right?
Right.
It's a crude way to define it. The macro and the micro merge. Well, that was actually what happened as the mixed corporate media after the satellite environment were merged through the instant replay. And so the hologram became a metaphor, and Salvador Dali made an art form in 1973. He turned the hologram very quickly into a little gallery demonstration, an installation. He was aware that not the object of the hologram, but the effect of the hologram, which is what's popularized in the holographic universe, that book by Michael somebody, right?
Yes.
anyways, the hologram, the effect of a technology, before it becomes widely used, communicates before actually people are using it. So the effect of television was happening before people were having television. Mm-hmm. For example, Surratt, the great painter Surratt, S-E-U-R-A-T, mm-hmm. he created pointillism, that just at the end of the 19th century where he would create paintings with little dots.
Yes.
He was actually miming what vision would be like under the pixelated TV screen 50 years before it showed up.
Yes.
So, you know, artists and scientists pick up the effects and the metaphysical implications. So
but
the,
what is it for us, bodies?
For us, the hologram means seeing in all directions at once.
But that we're a hologram.
Our minds think the possibility and effect of what I just said,
okay.
seeing in all directions at once.
Okay.
It resonates all through culture immediately. So what was the fad of the 70s besides punk? It was disco. The satellite as a little shimmering disco with many mirrors on it. Remember the saddle, the disco ball?
Yeah.
That was the visualization of seeing inside the ball. You would be seeing in all directions and all media reflections at once.
Okay.
All right? So it's amazing how pop culture reflects what's the hidden effect of the hologram before it actually comes out. We don't actually have technically a hologram even yet.
So are you saying then that you're talking about the disco ball? I mean, the person who thought up the disco ball, all of these things, the Android meme, its creation, technology, all of this is unbeknownst to the originator, correct?
That's right. That's right. The effects is unbeknownst. Bill Gates had no idea when he was working in his garage, tinkering in the early 70s and trying to figure out how to make a computer, that 30 years later, they'd be banning laws. They'd be creating laws to bam, spam that's misspelled and trying to, you know, grow your vagina from India. Him and Steve Jobs were down there and said, oh, boy, we'll be able to have everybody be able to store their own information and be able to communicate. Yeah, they had some fantasies. The inventor is always the last to understand what the effects are of what he's making. And he doesn't even know that there are artists and thinkers figuring out the effects and writing about it before Jobs and Gates were even born.
Mm-hmm.
Finnegan's Wake is the 1990s in print.
Hmm.
That's where we need to. This is what the immigrants need to hear about. They may not understand immediately, but at least it gives them something to think about that doesn't get them trapped where they're campaigning to get on the local station board in Pacifica Network or something. You know what I mean? And get lost in group mind dynamics.
Okay, talking about group mind dynamics, what a great lead into this question. If religion is for the masses, what do the elites have?
They have the masses. They do. They have the masses in whatever way you can fantasize. They have the attention of the masses. They have the human nature's perversity thrill of I control the masses. You know what I mean?
Mm.
They have the masses as putty.
Hmm. And what's in the Vatican catacombs? Hoffa.
No. There's nothing relevant to the 20th century there. There's stuff relevant to the Priory of Sion's history, where there are certain documents that Prince Charles's family has, the opposition, the Protestant Church has, the Vatican has their answers to when the Protestants attempt to say, hey, we're descended from the Nazarene. Yeah, we're the bloodline.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a problem. That was significant 100 years ago. It isn't significant now. And so the Vatican doesn't have anything of worth. Nothing. Not even the great painting that LaRouche always shows by Raphael of Socrates, of Plato and Aristotle going down there in the Palazzo and representing all the great thinkers of Greece. That's a big icon in LaRouche's iconography, and he brags about going to the private Vatican closets and mm-hmm. seeing the actual painting. But that is so puny, that wealth. The only wealth we have now is to make sense of what the meaning of those trends and those fads and those cultural artifacts back then. And the way to do it is to see that technology, which the people make, unbeknownst,
mm-hmm.
they make it,
mm-hmm.
and then we see how it conditions us. That's more important knowledge. So I recommend Marshall McLuhan's book, Through the Vanishing Point. You want to read the most intelligent exploration of art history? Read Through the Vanishing Point. It beats Baudrillard, it beats Derrida, it beats Frank Zappa, it beats Mad Magazine. Whatever you want to do, Paul Krasner, it's got it there first. And it's the most hilarious presentation, but at the same time, because it's so wise, it could be a religion.
Hmm. Is there such a thing as sovereignty? And if so, how do you attain it?
We all have sovereignty now once you're on the Internet. When you can dial into instant information, instant museums, anything. Go to the museum, Metropolitan Museum of New York here. Go to their website and look at their timeline. You can see hundreds of images of art that was made in different cultures all around the world, spread out over the last 20,000 years. You can see imagery and the parallels that cultures created. What they did, say, 1500 B.C., that no one could ever have seen before. So that's just something a kid or anybody can do. So you're experiencing what Einstein or anybody before Max Weber, nobody understood, experienced this. So that makes you king, queen, Rumpelstiltskin, and a black hole all at the same time. And so the autonomy that the modern digital computers give you allows you to engage in the 1984 cloned ESP society with an autonomy that I call voluntary ESP. You now only have to volunteer to communicate with humans and their extensions. It's all voluntary to show up on the planet now.
Okay, we will pick that up another time. I want to keep going because I have a bunch of questions to ask you. And, of course, we only have like 3 minutes left, man. Okay, so
We'll do a short answer to get as many questions in.
Okay, what about next year's elections? What's the – I know supposedly Bushwhacker's supposed to get in. Is he going to do that, legally? Is he going to have to try and manipulate the voting machines, or is he going to call some national emergency? Is there going to be another terrorist attack? What about the elections 2004?
Well, no one has achieved godhood yet, so nobody knows what's going to happen. I just say whatever's going to happen is going to be so insignificant that I would say a good, devoted act of media ecology is to ignore the whole election process completely. If the more involved you get involved that, you're going to have accidents this year.
But you know,
going to curse on anybody who pays attention to that process.
Oh, now, come on,
it's so puny.
Oh, come on. But hold it. There are people right now that are being held incommunicado by our government. While this idea of the Android meme and all of these puny little things are going on, us puny little humans are coming under a thumb of a bushwhacker who possibly would try and curtail our access to information.
Are you a reactionary? You're going to concentrate on 1,000 people being held while there are a million people being killed this year in the hospitals? What atrocity are you going to focus on to make yourself look human?
No. All I'm saying is that the what's going on in the hospitals is also one of the tentacles that are coming down from our government. That is all because
not
of our leaders.
Not coming from our government. It's coming from us, the technology we created. The technology that's known to be created by Microsoft was done by humans. He's just the bureaucratic agent of it, and what he created what he was the vehicle for us to create imprisoned ourselves. We are to blame, so we better start thinking and expressing ourselves in a whole different way to understand. And one way to express yourself is to be silent. That's one answer, because we don't know which expression is the right way, but we could coalesce. I mean, this whole thing of Dr. Dean, which is Connie's public name, taking on Bush, you can't get more of an election revolving around me than that. Dr. Dean versus the burning Bush, which is a key image in the early pages of Finnegan's Wake, with the name Bob right beside it. So if you want to survive next year and get these people out of jail, you better learn to talk the way I'm talking.
Yeah.
This is not my private language. This is what humanity should say about itself now, because we got to the point of saying this.
Hmm.
So that's what will free everybody. I mean, we are in worse hell than the prisoners that are sent up here under the Rockefeller laws in New York State. The average, and you are in hell way beyond them, because you got to go out and figure out how to get some meals. Those guys get their meals. You don't know where you're going to have a meal in two months.
Mm.
You may not get there. You're going to have to struggle. Everybody is struggling, even Mr. Lawrence Rockefeller is struggling. Everybody's struggling, even George Bush is. He's sure going to be happy that everybody forgot what happened in 2003, and they will forget because He's too busy trying to survive himself.
Right. Okay, so I understand the notion of, okay, which tragedy is going to make somebody feel.
Yeah, which is the more
significant. But all I'm saying is that there, but in that, of all the tragedies going on across, okay, I got to drop it, dagnabbit. I have 15 seconds and we're out of here. Bob, this is so great. It's fantastic talking with you. Let's pick this up. I have, you know, we got through four questions. I have like 20. So this is really great. Very fun. Just off the cuff with you, darling. So I look forward to continuing Freeform Bob coming up very soon. Okay, dear?
Okay, I'll talk to you later.
Okay, have a great night.
Thank you.
All right, loves. Yes, we have been speaking with Bob. Bob out of New York. All right. So, anyways, this is KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County. Gotta move and groove. And so, we'll be back.
Where the past and the future converge. Go to www.radioalchemy.com. RadioAlchemy.com for streaming audio and more.
Stay tuned for the second hour of Radio Alchemy on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.